We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
What's up, everybody? Nick Whalen, Alex Barutha. We are the RotoWire Fantasy Basketball Pod. It is Monday, April 29th, as we work our way, Alex, through round one of the NBA playoffs. We'll do a full recap of everything from the weekend, talk a little bit about the three games on the schedule tonight, look ahead to the rest of round one, and start to dissect the matchups we might see in round two. First and foremost, however, we are brought to you by one of our favorite sites, a site that we both play on all the time here in the state of Wisconsin, Prize Picks. It's the best way to get action on sports in more than 30 states across the country. Prize Picks is extremely simple to play. Couldn't be more simple. I can go and make my picks, submit my entry in less than 60 seconds. You just pick more, you just pick less on two or more stats, and you watch your winnings roll in. Looking at the board tonight, Alex, done a bit of preliminary research. You know, I've started dabbling in some Major League Baseball entries as well. A lot of fun to do that. You know, you can mix and match on Prize Picks too. I mean, we got NHL playoffs going on. I mean, you could throw in, like, you know, Juan Soto tonight against the Baltimore Orioles. I'm not even going to try to name anybody who currently plays in the NHL, but the point is, it doesn't have to be all NBA. If you're a jack of all trades, you want to mix and match some of these sports. That's one of the best things that Prize Picks offers. I like Michael Porter Jr. Taking the more on 27.5 points plus boards for him. Almost went more on this in points alone. In game four, he's gone more on this in three of the four games of the series. Nuggets might not have Jamal Murray tonight. That could mean more responsibility for Michael Porter Jr., but go check out Prize Picks. They have a ton of stats, a ton of player options. That's what makes it the number one daily fantasy sports app. And if you go play on Prize Picks right now, you can use their app or you can just go to prizepicks.com, put in the code ROTOPOD, ROTOPOD. That'll get you a first deposit match up to $100. That's ROTOPOD, ROTOPOD. For a first deposit match up to $100. Pick more, pick less, Prize Picks. It is that easy. All right, Alex, we'll go rapid fire through all of these series here. I think we might actually have to talk about Cleveland-Orlando, which is a stunning reversal based on how we've handled that one so far. But Orlando able to rally back, make that 2-2. All of a sudden, that's got really interesting. We only have one series that is completely wrapped up right now. And that, of course, is the lowly Phoenix Suns, Alex, who go down, I don't want to say valiantly. I mean, tip your cap to Devin Booker, who erupted for 49 last night. He was great, 20 of 21 at the line. Kevin Durant gave you 33 points. Bradley Beal, all-time bad elimination game by Bradley Beal. Outside of Durant and Booker, no other Suns player scored in double figures. That's been a hallmark for Phoenix in this series. Kind of crazy now to look back a week and a half ago when we were talking about the Suns being favored to win this series outright.
Yeah, I mean, Phoenix had Minnesota's number, but I think Phoenix just fell victim to the problems that they've had through a lot of the season, which was some turnover problems. I mean, they didn't turn it over a lot more necessarily than Minnesota, but they got crushed on the glass. as Christian comments that Phoenix got sunned. Yes, they did. They absolutely did get sunned.
That's one of the better comments of the season.
It is. Thank you. Thank you, Christian. What a joke of a big three. I honestly, Nick and I were talking on Slack about sort of like, Kevin Durant made a mention. Of course, after they lose, he goes to the reporters and he's like, I'm sick of being in the corner. You know, this team didn't use me.
All-time record, by the way, for fastest like coaching hit piece. Like that came out like the moment the buzzer sounded, boom. It's already out.
That was written after like game two. Yeah. Kevin Durant's like, I'm in the corner too much. He took 4 corner threes the entire series, by the way. 4. Or
12 total year. Threes.
Right. Yeah, they got crushed on the glass. I just really just not creative offensively. And Durant individually, as he does, puts up great efficiency numbers. But I don't know, man. Anthony Edwards completely took over this series. Gobert looked awesome. They didn't even need Karl Anthony Towns to play that well. He played efficiently, but he scored 19 points a game, which is like fine.
He was great last night. That was easily his best game of the series.
Yeah. But this is sort of, and some of the series are like this, where it's like, this is how being constructed really well as a team, having a great team concept, can really just overwhelm talent when guys are just out there hooping.
It's funny because Rich Paul was on NBA radio over the weekend. We know Rich Paul, associate of LeBron James. And you can catch us, by the way, on NBA radio tonight on the RotoWire NBA show. We will have James Posey joining us, a hero of mine in my childhood. I always think of him as a Hornet, even though I think he only played there like 2 years, but can't wait to chat with him. Rich Paul said, I think he was on with Isola, and basically was like, the big three doesn't really work anymore. You can't really construct a team like that. And I think Phoenix is just the latest example, and it's becoming more and more rare, right? I think the NBA salary structure is designed to no longer have these big threes, but it also feels like teams aren't really even trying it all that much. It's like Phoenix kind of lucked their way into this in some ways, where it's like you kind of got Bradley Beal for free. Obviously, you had to give something up, but you're taking on the contract. That was the bigger burden. But it's not like they had to give up a ton of pieces. They didn't make this team appreciably worse by acquiring Brad Beal. Durant essentially forced his way to Phoenix in a way that we've seen very few superstars be able to pull off. Like, I will not be hitting the open market. I would like you to trade me peacefully to this one team, please and thank you. And the Nets were happy to do that. So they kind of found their way into this big three. And, at the time, I didn't hate the idea. It's like you assemble that much scoring talent. I certainly didn't see them flaming out in round one. But you look at the teams that are having success around the league right now, and the one or maybe two superstars surrounded by a deep supporting cast that most importantly knows its role. I think we're back to that style of basketball being the dominant fashion, and it's working, right? It works for Minnesota. It certainly works for Denver. And, obviously you need a player like Anthony Edwards or Nikola Jokic to be the guy that ties that all together. But the Phoenix thing is just, the fit to me is worse than it should be. It's like, you look at this team and we just said Kevin Durant took 12 threes over the course of 4 playoff games. That's not enough. He took plenty of shots, but the shot selection has to be better. They only took 26 threes per game as a team. That is far and away the fewest that any team is averaging so far in the playoffs. And to me, they have the personnel for it, right? It's like Kevin Durant is a good 3-point shooter. Bradley Beal, historically, very good 3-point shooter. Devin Booker, good 3-point shooter. Even some of these role guys, Eric Gordon, Grayson Allen, Josh Okogie, for Christ's sake, Royce O'Neal. These guys can spot up and shoot threes. I don't know if there was like a kind of a revolt against Frank Vogel. Certainly that piece that came out last night made it seem that way. But it feels like a team that, from our perspective at least, and look, we're just sitting here analyzing this on a basketball podcast, but it's pretty easy to say, man, like you just can't be getting outscored every single night from three the way that you are and expect to win series against good teams. Like, to me, the fix is somewhat obvious, and the Suns just feel like internally they've kind of resisted that.
Yeah, they don't. I mean, we've known this. They live in the mid-range, but that's also kind of been their weakness. I mean, that gives you a pretty high floor when those shooters are Kevin Durant, Bradley Beal, and Devin Booker, who are taking those mid-range jumpers. And they actually got to the rim a lot more in game 4. It's like, it's a little too late, actually. Like, Minnesota, and I feel like some other teams have done this to Phoenix as well. They just sort of, they chase them off the 3-point line. They funnel them to the rim. And KD, I think, is especially guilty of this, where he beats his defender off the dribble. So he doesn't see his defender. He sees the rim, and so he just shoots. He's like, well, open shot. He doesn't force the issue, go to the basket. And again, they were doing that in this game, but you're already down 3-0, man. Like, it's too late.
Right. And I mean, it's Kevin Durant. So if there's one guy you want living in the mid-range, it's him, you know. And I think there are other issues here. I mean, the rebounding discrepancy is the other thing that stands out. I mean, they were getting out-rebounded by about 14 boards per game for the series. They were getting crushed. I mean, Minnesota basically doubled them up in terms of offensive boards. And, you know, that's part of the way Minnesota is constructed. I think the success that Phoenix had against Minnesota in the regular season, specifically those last two games in like the final 10 and including game 82, I think maybe gave us a bit of a rosier impression. And yeah, Minnesota, I forget if it was Chris Finch or one of the assistants basically came out and said that, yeah, when we lost game 82, we were not showing them everything, right? Like, I think Minnesota wanted to win that game, but I think they were okay not winning it and not sacrificing any kind of strategic points for the series. And you know, I think I got sucked into that too. You know, you see Phoenix as a favorite. You're like, man, what do they know that we don't know? And to be fair, Minnesota had, I think, pretty significant questions coming into this series as far as experience, as far as how is Rudy Gobert going to fare in this series? How is Karl Anthony Towns, who just came back from an injury, how's he going to look? Is Anthony Edwards ready to make that jump? So I think part of it, obviously, is Phoenix came up short. But I do think if we rewind this 2 weeks, you got to give a lot of credit to Minnesota, because this was, I think Timberwolves fans would say, yeah, we were confident we were going to win this series. I don't think anybody thought they were going to win this in four. I mean, this has been a dominant series from Minnesota. And I still think we're headed toward Timberwolves Nuggets in round two. I mean, if Jamal Murray doesn't play tonight, maybe that gives the Lakers just a sliver of hope. But I don't think Denver's blowing a 3-0 lead. That's just not going to happen. Nuggets Timberwolves. If Minnesota carries this over, that is going to be a banger of a Western Conference semifinal.
It's going to be amazing. I mean, that's must see immediately. You mentioned the Timberwolves, man. I can't say enough good things about Anthony Edwards, who has been a good playoff performer, but it seems like he has officially reached like a completely new level, smack talking Booker, KD, basically everybody on the other team throughout the whole series. Jaden McDaniels in game three, basically had the game of his life. I think it was game three.
Yep.
No, game two.
Game two
either
game
one.
Three,
he played well the whole series. I think it was game two that I'm thinking of.
Yeah.
Nickeil Alexander-Walker is kind of having a career revival. Is able to step in and spell Mike Conley. Obviously, Naz Reid, Sixth Man of the Year, was great. And I think, you know, again, assuming they meet Denver, I think they're going to give Denver a legit challenge. I would still take Denver, but a 7-game series would not surprise me.
Yeah, I mean, the difference, and there are a number of things we can point to, but the difference between Jaden McDaniels scoring output and Bradley Beal scoring output in this series can't be 2 points per game. That's a problem for Phoenix. Yes. You know, like Bradley Beal has to win that matchup head to head. And he did not. I mean, I think there's a very strong argument, if not a certainty, that Jaden McDaniels was a far better player in this series than Bradley Beal. And that's the thing. When you build this top heavy roster, it's like those guys have to bring it. They absolutely have to bring it every single night or you're in big trouble. Right. And losing Grayson Allen, certainly that didn't flip the series to me. Maybe it changes from Phoenix losing the series in five to Phoenix losing the series in four. I don't think any Suns fan is like, man, if we had Grayson Allen, we probably would have swept this thing. But you know, you're depending on Eric Gordon. You're depending on these role guys that just did not play well. And you know, I think obviously we have to now look forward for Phoenix. And I think Frank Vogel's going to take the fall. I don't know if this ultimately results in him losing his job, but the foundation is pretty clearly laid already for this one to land at the feet of Vogel. I think he's going to get kind of a raw deal twice in a row based on how his tenure ended with the Lakers. I don't know if that's fair. You know, I think in the story that did come out last night, you know, there's something about, you know, Vogel kind of started laying into the guys late in the season and, you know, kind of lost the locker room in that way because that's not really who he is. And they saw through it. So you can see both sides of that, but I don't know if there's a coach out there who just flips the switch for this team. Durant's going to be a year older. Bradley Beal's not getting any better. Devin Booker, you could argue maybe there's like a slight level that he can go up, but does it ultimately change your fortunes from getting swept out of round one to all of a sudden making the finals? Like even in terms of the tweaks that they could make to the rest of the roster, I don't know what's out there. Like I actually thought Phoenix, given the spot they were in when the roster was basically just those three guys, like to get Nurkic for free, to get a lot of these surrounding role players, they stole Grayson Allen. Like it's not a good supporting cast, but I think they maximized it about as well as they could. I mean, the one thing you could say is maybe you need another big man who's not Drew Eubanks, but they're going to have trouble. I think adding anybody of real consequence.
Yeah, it's not going to be easy. And like you mentioned, the new CBA, you know, is only going to make things more difficult to continue having a team like this. And not only did Kevin Durant, you know, saying the media that he didn't like how he was used, Stephen A. Smith comes out and he's like, "Ah, here Devin Booker wants to play in New York." And it's like this is already starting to fall apart. If you believe what Stephen A. Smith is reporting, but I just your point's right. Where like, what do you do from here? I assume they will fire Frank Vogel because they already changed all their role players. Next thing you got to do is the coach.
They do seem committed to James Jones, who I think has done a fine job. Again, and it's easy to look back and say, man, that's what a disaster this was. But if you have a chance to get Kevin Durant on your team, historically, you just do that, and it usually works out pretty well. So I don't really fault James Jones for going all in on this. I think you can look back and say, like, man, this team was in the finals a few years ago. It's like, do you regret parting ways with Mikal Bridges, Cam Johnson, kind of breaking up that core? I think the issue with that argument is you weren't going to get that version of Chris Paul going forward, you know? So I think there was going to be an inflection point no matter what, because there's, you know, Chris Paul was on such a different schedule than the rest of that team. But
yeah,
I mean, the options for Phoenix are basically run it back and hope for better luck. Sure, you could chance it if you want. The West is going to be just as good, if not better, next season. And you don't have the built-in excuse like you do if you're Milwaukee, where you're like, look, we didn't have Giannis for the whole series. We didn't have Dame for half the series. Everybody got injured at the worst time. It's like, it's convenient, but it's also true. Phoenix doesn't have that. It's like, you had your guys, and you still got absolutely clocked by Minnesota in four games. The other options, of course, are start shopping Kevin Durant and or Devin Booker and admit defeat and try to kind of reset this thing as quickly as you can. You can't really trade Brad Beal unless he asks out, because he has the no trade.
That's a problem. I always feel like that sort of thing is a last case scenario. It's because you have all these guys on the team, and you know, when you blow it up and you tank, the goal is to eventually get another team with guys this talented. And I know it doesn't work, or it didn't work this year. So you sort of instinctively are like, well, why would it work next year? Team is still really good. I mean, they have 49 wins, you know, right, in a really tough Western Conference. Like at the end of the day, these guys are so good that it is about championships. It sort of just depends on what ownership wants to do. Because Matt Ishbia, obviously very aggressive in getting Kevin Durant. So, and like, the earlier you sell on these guys, the better return you're going to get. I mean, this is the peak of, right, like, Durant's not going to get more valuable. This is the peak of Booker's value. I don't even know what Beal's value in theory is, even if he hadn't.
I don't think it's there. It's the worst contract in the NBA.
Probably. Yeah. But the thing is, to your point, you know, you're like, well, Mikal, you know, they could have had Mikal Bridges and Cam Johnson and done the Chris Paul thing, but the Nets suck.
Yeah,
their Nets are terrible, and they have Mikal Bridges and Cam Johnson. I mean, they're horrible. So I look, and obviously Bridges should not be a number one, and Cam Johnson should not be like a number two. But
right,
I don't know. I don't even know if they're going to think about blowing it up, to be honest. I think they should think about it, but I don't know if they will.
Yeah, I mean, they're in a somewhat similar situation to Milwaukee. You could argue the Lakers as well. It's like you have options, but none of those options are overly appealing. And I think you bring up a good point. It's like, this team, if you want to talk yourself into like, man, maybe we would have won 55 games if all these guys were healthy, you kind of forget how much time each of those big three, specifically Beal and even Booker, missed during the regular season. So like, this series is a disaster. The way the season ended is a disaster, but the whole season in and of itself, you know, it's not like you just scraped your way into the playoffs. I guess they kind of did, but they avoided the play-in in an ultra competitive Western Conference. Like, that's all hope is not lost. Like, it wouldn't be that crazy if this team stayed healthy next year and all of a sudden they're the three seed and maybe they have better luck or they get a better matchup. Who knows? But I think that leads to an interesting point of so many teams right now are basically title or bust. And it's like, man, if you don't get close to that goal, got to blow it up, right? It's like, we're going to have this conversation at some point with Milwaukee when they lose this series. It's like Philly kind of feels like they're in that zone all of a sudden. Like, if Cleveland blows this series, they could be another team that has to make sweeping changes. Like, there are so many teams that are in extreme win now mode. I think the Clippers fit that as well, where not everybody can win. One team can win. Only one team can make the finals. Only two teams can make the West Finals. But there almost has to be, to me, somewhat of a resetting of goals, because with as much talent and as deep as the league is at the top right now, just because you don't make the conference finals, you don't make the NBA finals, it might be a bit of an overreaction to say, man, we got to blow this thing up. It's like only one or two teams can really go into next season as like the favorites or the co-favorites to make the finals. And it feels like that's the goal of every team, is to be like the shoe in. We're going to make the finals no matter what. I don't know if that's the KD Warriors that kind of messed up the balance of the league where it feels like it doesn't make sense to put stars together unless you have just like this overwhelming chance to win the finals. But that's just not how it's going to be for a long time because the league is so good.
And to some extent, I feel like the stars set those expectations for themselves when they want to join a super team. Sure. What's the point of all these guys joining the same team if it's just to like, we're going to be pretty good.
Right.
We're going to do our thing. We're just going to hang out, maybe win a first round series, be pretty competitive in round two. It's like, no, they set those expectations. And honestly, the fans have those expectations. I mean, you don't do everything for the fans, but if
I do.
If you put James Harden, Paul George, and Kawhi Leonard on the team, all the fans are going to be like, okay, well, now we're a title team. Like, why else would you be doing this? Like, this is the whole point.
100%.
As opposed to being like Orlando or Indiana or somebody who it's like, it's all homegrown. Maybe you make one trade, the Halliburton trade, and it's all kind of gravy. It's like, it's fine if you win a first round. It's amazing if you win a first round series. So some of it is basing expectations.
I think you lose the illusion of progress when you put a team together like that.
Yes.
It has to work right away. There's no buildup period, right? And I think this goes back to the LeBron Heat. You could even take it back to the Allen, Pierce, Garnett Celtics. Obviously, the Durant Warriors. It's like these guys are teaming up, like you said, specifically so they can feel like I wouldn't say have a free pass to the finals, but you want to feel like you have a free pass to at least the conference finals. And it's just, it's not going to work. It doesn't work like that anymore. And I think the league has taken steps in terms of the structure of the salary cap, in terms of penalizing these teams that are luxury tax repeaters and things like that to make it more difficult to build a team like that. And if that was the NBA's goal, I think it's worked. I think it's worked.
I think so too. Yeah.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
With everyone fighting for attention, how can your business stand out and connect with customers? Easy, with Constant Contact. Constant Contact's award-winning marketplace platform has helped millions of small businesses stand out, stay top of mind, and see big results fast. It's okay if you don't know much about marketing. Constant Contact's writing assistant tools and automation features help you craft messaging and say the right things at the right time. I use this to help write and send my email newsletters, and you should too. So get going and start growing your business today with a free trial at ConstantContact.com. Just go to ConstantContact.com right now. Constant Contact, helping the small stand tall. ConstantContact.com.
You know, if I would have applied myself, I could have gone to the NBA.
You think so?
Yeah, I think so. But it's just like, it's been done. You know, I didn't want to, I was like, I don't want to be a follower. Hi, I'm Jason Concepcion.
And I'm Shea Serrano. And we are back. We have a new podcast from Wondery. It's called Six Trophies.
Woo!
And it's the best.
Each week, Shea Serrano and I are combing through all the NBA storylines, finding the best, most interesting, most compelling stories, and then handing out six pop culture-themed trophies for six basketball-related activities.
Trophies like the Dominic Toretto, I Live My Life a Quarter Mile at a Time trophy, which is given to someone who made a short-term decision with no regard for future consequence.
Or the Christopher Nolan Tenet trophy, which is given to someone who did something that we didn't understand.
Catalina Wine Mixer trophy.
Ooh, the Lauryn Hill You Might Win Some, But You Just Lost One trophy. And what's more, the NBA playoffs are here, so you want to make Six Trophies your go-to companion podcast through all the craziness. Follow Six Trophies on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.
All right, so that's postmortem on the Phoenix Suns. Things are bleak, but who knows? They'll figure out something this summer. I don't think the Suns are just going to fade away or set, if you will. Let's go to Clippers-Mavs. This has been a It's been a fun series. It's been a weird series. You know, the Clippers are now 2-0 without Kawhi Leonard. They're 0-2 when Kawhi plays. Obviously, Kawhi didn't really look like himself. Was not shocking to me that he ended up sitting out yesterday. Was shocking to me that they built a 31-point lead in the first half without Kawhi Leonard. Mavs obviously rallied back, briefly took the lead late in this game. Incredible, incredible game from Kyrie Irving, who's been great in this series. Not a fantastic effort from Doncic, 29, 10, and 10. I mean, he's on that short list of guys that even the bad games are going to look great. But this was not a banner showing from him. 1 of 9 from beyond the arc. Kyrie, in contrast, 6 of 12. Luka's gotten a lot of credit for his defense in this series. It was horrific. Horrific yesterday. Yes. So whoever put together the supercut of Luka trying to stay in front of Harden, thank you for doing that. I love Luka. I don't want to speak ill of him. He killed them down the stretch, I thought, defensively. You know, you could argue Jason Kidd maybe killed them not having any big men on the court, just allowing the Clippers and Harden to repeatedly get into the lane and get easy baskets late. I think the other side of this is I got to tip my cap. As I grab my cap here, I'm going to put it on and tip it to James Harden, who's had 2 all-time Harden games in this series. And I mean that in a positive way. You could say all-time Harden games in the playoffs. It could go either way. Part of the reason that I like Dallas so much in this series was I don't trust James Harden in the playoffs. Historically, it's been a bad bet. He was incredible in game one. He was even better yesterday.
Harden was amazing. Luka absolutely could not guard it. Luka was a turnstile. It was hard to watch.
The one that sticks with me is when Harden got by him and he was kind of like trailing him, but like trying to guard him from behind. Like he was almost going to like wrap his arms around and like try to blur his vision. Like it was bad. It was really bad.
Yeah. And there were some, you know, Luka help defense that I would qualify as like when you, I don't even know. He just kind of stuck his arm out like a little jab. Kyrie really was the savior for them. He was making some absurd shots against the Clippers. I mean, you mentioned it. LA got out to such a big lead. Dallas claws back. But throughout the game, ultimately it felt like Dallas, like the Clippers were just getting better looks, I thought. And, you know, in game one of the series, the Clippers made a million contested looks. And to me, I was like, that was using sort of that as a leverage point too. I think Mavericks can come back in game two. But the defensive breakdowns for Dallas were so bad. And Luka's part of that. I mean, the reality of the NBA is like, if you're getting blown by, it creates an advantage. And when you have someone as good as James Harden, who did that for a living in Houston, just getting by his man and then knowing exactly what to do, whether that be take the shot or pass it, it's like you can't survive that. So look, this to me is, I think, probably the most difficult series for me left to read. Like my feel for this series is, I have no idea who's going to win. I like absolutely no idea.
I don't either. I kind of planted my heels in on the Mavs, so I can't back off of that. But this feels like it could go either way. It's minus 190 for the Mavs right now, which is interesting. Clippers plus 160. Yeah, I think Kawhi factors into that more than anything, right? Just not knowing if he's going to be back at any point in the series. But again, the Clippers are 2-0 without him. And would I wager that sustains over what could be 3 more games in the series? No. That would be incredible if Dallas like loses the series in 6 and they go 0-4 without Kawhi. But it's possible. I mean, if Harden plays at this level, that changes the calculus for me. That is not something that I had really factored in. I think Dallas is still struggling to find that third guy. There's not an obvious culprit for them like there is for the Suns. You know, it was supposed to be Bradley Beal. You know, with Dallas, it's like you're asking a lot for like, hey, PJ, we need 20 out of you every single night. You know, I think Tim Hardaway just completely disappearing. Like he literally was inactive for game 4. But even before that was just not a part of this team. It's like, this is a guy that was, according to the odds, like your runaway 6th man of the year midway through the season. I mean, he has fallen off a cliff for them. Not having his offense, I think, has really hurt them. You look at the guys who are playing real minutes off the bench for Dallas. It's Maxi Kleba, who's just kind of hanging out there. Jason Kidd loves him. He did hit a big 3 yesterday, but he took 1 shot in 22 minutes. Derek Lively, who's basically just a lob finisher. And, you know, then you're asking Josh Green. He's had some moments, not a scorer necessarily. You know, Dante Exum, you know, Hardy, those guys aren't even in the rotation right now for the Mavs. So it's easy to say, yeah, they need that third guy, but the roster is also not really constructed that way. I do think we see a better version of Luka the rest of the series. He's had his moments, certainly, but this has not been like an all-time Luka Doncic series so far. So if I'm Dallas, I probably feel like I should be up 3-1 right now. I'm kicking myself for falling behind huge in game one, falling behind even bigger in game four. But I still think the Mavs are in good shape here, especially if we don't see the real version of Kawhi Leonard.
Yeah, I mean, to me, the series is almost becoming more about the supporting casts than the stars to some extent, because the stars are just, they're doing their thing. Like, yeah, Paul George, Harden, Kyrie, and Doncic have all had like really strong moments throughout the series, and have been good overall. And it is just Dallas, like the ball swings to guys like Derek Jones, or Josh Green, like you mentioned. They can't do anything with the ball. They no confidence. Gafford and Lively, the Gafford Lively Kleber minutes are just kind of all over the place. It's not like really clear what they want to do with that. And the Clippers, this is part of the strength of the Clippers, is not only do they have a really good top three, I mean, like you mentioned, Kawhi's not gonna be playing in two of these games, their role players are all really established. Like Zubac, really good. Terrence Mann, I think, is a little bit overrated, but an awesome defender, right? Will 100% take on, like, I can guard Kyrie, I can guard Doncic. And then you have Westbrook, who, again, he's kind of hit or miss, but he's all energy. Does not lack confidence. Then Norman Powell was a legit Sixth Man of the Year candidate. Maybe fringe, but that's who he is. Yeah. He can get buckets. Part of me, you know, and the Clippers are the higher seed. So if this goes seven, you know, that's going to be in their advantage, which is why I'm actually kind of surprised the Mavericks are -190, because the Clippers do have the better supporting cast and they have home court in game seven, potentially.
Yeah, I think it all just comes down to Kawhi. And if we get positive news on him, that probably moves a little bit. I mean, Zubac has been great in this series. No question about that. He's been the best big man, most consistent big man in this series. Talk about Harden. I mean, 26-7 for him, 54, 50, 91 shooting splits. I mean, this is about as well as this could have gone so far for him. Luka's shooting 39% from the field in the series. And that's, you know, I think that's also a story. He's 13 of 49 from three for the Mavs. So I think if we get closer to regular season Luka, the Mavs are probably up 3-1 right now and they're feeling a lot better. So I do think that comes around. I would like to think he's not shooting 26% from three for the rest of the series, but who knows? I mean, he's looked kind of agitated. Like, even in the games that they've won, like he's been feisty. I don't know if he's thrilled with, you know, the lack of support other than Kyrie. And you know, Kyrie's doing Kyrie things. He's at 51, 49, 91 for the series. He's been just as good as Harden. He's basically matched him. But like you said, it's been the role players for the Clippers who've been able to step up. All right, let's look at some of the other series. We get Denver LA tonight. LA has at least temporarily staved off elimination, getting the win on Saturday. You know, the stat that was going around most this weekend is just the time led for the Lakers versus the Mavs. Like, the Lakers have led like almost 80% of the series. They've led every game at halftime. They've had multiple double-digit leads. If Jamal Murray does not play tonight, the door is cracked open for the Lakers. For one, I think Murray might play. I mean, the line, last I checked, I think it was Denver 7 or 7.5. 7 right now at DraftKings. That, to me, implies that he's playing. I mean, the series is back in Denver, so who knows. But the Lakers have a glimmer of hope here. If Murray is out tonight and maybe hampered the rest of the series, we saw that, you know, take its toll on Denver not being able to close out in game four.
Yeah. To me, that line implies that Murray's probably going to be in there. Cause I think there were 7-point favorites in the other games at home.
Yeah. When about Murray that. It was in that range. Yeah.
Yeah. In game four, LeBron was awesome. He looked like, you know, there were some moments in the other games where he looked especially old. He was like not using his left hand at all. He like whiffed like multiple layups trying to go right hand, left side of the basket. And I'm like, what are you?
Yeah.
And this
game two and three, that. He was bad finishing at the rim, especially game two.
Yeah. And this game, it was a completely different energy for him. This was like back against the wall, LeBron.
Yeah.
You know, Anthony Davis was a monster on the glass, and you get another Russell and Reeves game, which is like, this is what the Lakers needed, which is like, yes, LeBron needs to be 100%. AD just does what he does. And then one of Russell or Reeves needs to pop off, and both popped off. And you can get the win. And I know there was some stuff about the Nuggets didn't have like their warm-up equipment or something going on before the game. I don't know how much to read into that. look, to me, it's not a shock that the Lakers, if the series ends tonight, it's not a shock to me that the Lakers won a game and one of those games are at home. But yeah, it does get interesting if Curry doesn't play tonight. Definitely gets interesting.
Yeah. I mean, like, Lakers have played, I think, a pretty good series. You know, it's like the bad Russell game came at the worst time, where it's like, if he just gives them a slightly below average game, this series is maybe 2-2 right now. And we're talking about a completely different narrative, but that's also what you sign up for when you have D'Angelo Russell, right? Like, this is the reason that he's D'Angelo Russell. It's like, yeah, he'll start a game 5 of 5 from three, and then he'll go 1 of 9 the next game. Like, that's why he's not in the Jamal Murray, Kyrie Irving, you know, type of tier of these like secondary great guards. That's what's always held him back, is the lack of consistency. Reeves has just had a weird series to me. He hasn't been bad. It's like, a lot of the numbers look okay. The raw numbers, you know, 16 points, 4 boards, 4 assists. That's kind of where he was sitting in the regular season, 46% from the field. He has not shot it well from three. The Lakers in general have not shot it well from three. Like, they don't have a single player in this series, I guess, other than Russell. But it's funny, the numbers work out to Russell shooting 35% from three. Obviously, they've come in bunches. But, like, nobody's having a great series from beyond the arc. Like, LeBron has been their best three-point shooter at 36%. They're at 30% for the series as a team, which is not good. It's been offset by Denver being even worse, though. I mean, they're at 28% for three. MPJ is really the only guy who's been consistent for them. He's at 44%. He's having an incredible series, by the way. I think he has been, other than D'Angelo Russell, he's been the single biggest swing piece. You know, like, Jokic has done exactly what you'd expect. Murray, about what you'd expect. LeBron, AD, they're both playing well. If Michael Porter Jr. doesn't hit some of the crazy contested looks that he's hit throughout this series, again, I think it's a different story. The Lakers have played well enough for this to be 2-2.
MPJ is in the zone. The thing is that he's gotten competent on defense, and that's been a no huge. Question. He's not giving those points back up on the other end like he was early in his career. And physically, he looks good. You know, after all of his injuries, so that's good too. But yeah, the fact that Denver is shooting 28% from three and is still up in this series, up 3-1, is just tells you how much they're dominating every other aspect of basketball. Mm-hmm. Like, fewer turnovers, more offensive rebounds, they get to the free throw line more. And yes, I mean, the Lakers have been up a huge portion of this series. As AD's had a really good series and LeBron had a really good game, but you just can't escape from Jokic. Like, he's always on your heels.
What was your opinion of the Jokic touch pass, by the way?
Oh my God.
It's getting universally lauded. And then I saw some pushback. Granted, it was from Lakers fans that are like, if you've ever played basketball, this wasn't that impressive.
That pass was insane.
It was cool. I wouldn't say it was insane. It was cool.
I don't know. I mean, it's one thing, you sort of try to imagine yourself as Jokic, which is like impossible.
Yeah.
But it's like, imagine you're just sprinting down the court and the ball just lands in front of you.
Yeah.
And you know, I mean, he knew, I forgot who got the pass. Was it MPJ?
Yeah.
You know the guy's over there, but to just not catch it and throw it, to like no look slap it, it's like, what? In a playoff game? It's like, I mean, just, I think what surprises me, what was amazing to me about that is just the complete confidence to, like, he had no second guessing whether that pass was going to make it there. He's like, yep, there you go. Which is like, if you did that in a pickup game and it worked out, you would feel like you were like, if I did that in a pickup game tonight when I play, I would feel like people would get mad at me if I messed it up. Like, I would feel like it's too risky for a no stakes pickup game. And he's doing it in this context.
I thought the more impressive part was him tracking the ball like Tyreek Hill. You know, there's the one angle from the front where you could see him kind of almost looking behind and essentially tracking, all right, I know exactly this is where it's going to bounce. I'm going to get in position for the tap. But obviously a very cool play. I was just wondering if you had a hot take on it.
No.
Let's do Bucks Pacers. Tough series to evaluate, man. And it's so funny. I can't remember if we talked about this last week, but all of my Bucks fan friends have turned on the Pacers. They've turned on Tyrese Haliburton, who I thought, you know, he ruffled some feathers with the Bucks specifically earlier this year, but he's a Wisconsin guy. I think generally a pretty likable guy. This is just a great reminder and a great exercise in facing a team in a playoff series when it's not going well, just makes you hate the entire team. I was like, I'm in a couple of, you know, Bucks centric group chats, and throughout the game, it's like, God, I hate Haliburton. I'm so sick of Miles Turner. Pascal Siakam sucks. I'm like, this, no matter who you play, you're going to end up hating that team no matter what. And that's, this is the reason everybody hates LeBron, because he's destroyed so many fan bases over the course of the years. Like, you could go count up which teams he's had like a devastating series against. And yeah, they all hate LeBron. So yeah, Bucks fans now hate the Pacers. It's 3-1. Miles Turner's been incredible. And I mean, I want to, you know, I think it's easy to look back and be like, you know, I told Jeff on the radio, I'm like, kind of embarrassing they only won by 13 despite shooting the ball that well. Are they going to go 22 of 43 in game six? Probably not. Or game five, excuse me. Probably not. But the quality of looks that the Pacers are generating to me is completely sustainable. Unless the Bucks change something on defense, which they don't seem to be all that interested in. And granted, the personnel is an issue with no Dame and no Giannis, but it wasn't to me like one of those games where you're like, oh my God, how do they keep hitting these? It was just, it's wide open three after wide open three after wide open three.
That has been what the Bucks have done for most of the year, is give up open threes. And as you were talking, I fired this up. Guess what team has taken the most wide open threes in the playoffs? The Indiana
Pacers.
I'm
going to guess the Indiana Pacers. Okay.
29 wide open three-pointers per game in the playoffs. 29 per game. Next team, Oklahoma City Thunder at 20.
They're taking more 19. Wide open threes than the Suns are taking total threes.
Yeah. Indiana 29 wide open threes. OKC at number two with 20. Then New Orleans at 20. Miami Heat at 19. So like the Bucks are such an outlier in, they're like lapping the field basically and allowing open threes. And that's not going to change because that was the case all year. The Bucks can't guard pick and roll actions. They can't really guard any screening action because they have no backcourt defenders. Will Indiana shoot 51% from three? No, but they're getting so many wide open ones that they're going to shoot 40% on those. And are you going to get 20 points again? Malik Beasley. Middleton hurt his ankle. Lopez had 27. Portis only played 7 minutes because he got ejected because he lost his mind early in the game. The series is just over. The series was over. Like, when it was actually over was when Dame got ruled out for this game. That was when, in the group chats, I was like, well, farewell, everyone. It was a good year. Like, that to me, it wasn't even a question. It's just over.
Yeah. One of my group chats just turned into Packers talk mid game. started talking about like, where does Marshawn Lloyd fit into this backfield? That type of stuff. It certainly felt that way. At the same time, I actually think the Bucks put in about as good of an effort as they could
have
yesterday. It's like, I thought that game would get way out of hand faster than it did. And especially when you factor in how well Indiana shot the ball, it's like, it felt like the Bucks were down 30 the entire game. And somehow it was like an 8-point game. Chris Middleton, I think if there's one silver lining to take out of this, especially if Milwaukee does go down, in game five, it's that Chris Middleton still has it. I think the question is, how long can he hang on to this? But I mean, he's kind of fighting through multiple injuries at this point. The Bucks offense is non-existent. There are always two, maybe sometimes three non-threats on the court for Milwaukee without Dame and without Giannis. I think that the level of difficulty is cranked up for Middleton, and he's still carrying this team. It's been a nice reminder, I think, that he's still that guy. Lopez offensively was fine in game four. I think defensively, protecting the rim, he just hasn't really been the same guy. There's a lot of shots that you're kind of used to Brook challenging or even blocking throughout the season that just feel like, it's like, how is Nemhard consistently finishing over you this often? I've been a little bit frustrated with that. Pat Beverly kind of is what he is at this point. The Portis ejection, it hurt them in some ways, but Bobby's also been horrendous in this series. Like, I know some of the per game numbers might look okay, but I think he's actually hurt them more than he's helped them.
Yeah. I mean, Portis is fine. I don't know. I mean, he's a six man. He should be a six man playing six man minutes in the playoffs. He should be playing 20 minutes. We have to give the Bucks some credit because the game, I'm with you where I'm looking at the score. I'm like, really? Still close? It ultimately just was the third quarter where the Pacers won the quarter by 10 points. And that's kind of what pulled them away. And you have to give some credit to, a lot of these guys, not just like Lopez, Middleton and Beasley, but Connaughton came in, played 22. AJ Green played 21 minutes. Andre Jackson played 25 minutes. Like, they almost saved this for the Bucks. They really did. to try to, you know, live another day or breathe some life into the team that, you know, with the hope that Dame could come back maybe, or that maybe we could force six or seven and then Giannis can come back. But I think emotionally at this point, where the series is at, it's going to be tough. I would be shocked if I know it's at home. I would still be shocked if the Bucks, you know, won the next game. I don't think we have any information right now about Giannis, but I would be surprised if he came back. So I think this is done.
I will say this: season is on the line. Obviously, when you're down 3-1, I don't want Giannis to come back. No. I don't want him to come back for game five, and unless he's 100%, and I obviously myself have no way of knowing this, but don't risk it. Do not risk it. The last thing you need is a, you know, Kevin Durant final game with the Warriors situation that sets this team back significantly further. So just don't risk it. The excuses are there for the Bucks. I don't want to make them, but again, in contrast to a team like Phoenix, it's pretty easy to sit back and say, look, we blew it last year against Miami, but Giannis missed half the series. This year, Giannis gets hurt in what, game like 78? Dame gets hurt midway through the series. It's like there aren't many teams that would survive this. Look, and I think the way Indiana's played, it's like it kind of like they should have won game three. You know, you go into double overtime, that you had multiple opportunities. They gave up a billion offensive rebounds, including, I believe, five on one possession late in that game. So the revisionist stuff is going to be there, but sometimes you just have bad luck, you know. And what I hope is that this doesn't trigger some sort of like crazy sweeping decision by the Milwaukee Bucks or by Giannis or Dame, you know, should they kind of look at this roster. It's not a perfect situation, but to me, I would be more content if I'm Milwaukee saying, all right, this just didn't work out. The luck was not on our side this year. We'll run it back next year. We'll assume Giannis and Dame are healthy and we still feel like we are a title contender. I think it's easier to tell that to yourself if you're Milwaukee than some of these other teams that might go down in round one.
Yeah. And it was a tough personal year for Lillard. I think that's some of it as well, but it's tough because you get Lillard. This team is old. It's a very old team. And so part of the calculus of getting Lillard was like, we're trying to maximize this window that we have right now with our fairly old team. And so losing a year like this, it just sucks. And their ceiling should have been higher. And I think that at times they were worse than their record, but then you could always say, well, Middleton's going to come back, so they're actually better than their record. And it was so easy as a Bucks fan to talk yourself into the team. Cause you're like, well, who in the East is really that much better, you know? And then at other points you take some bad losses and you're like, how can this team be losing like this? To some extent, I'm sure it's how Phoenix fans feel. I think it's right to draw certain comparisons to them because you see all the talent on the floor and you're like, how are we not like just smoking other teams?
Yeah. Look ahead line for game five is Indiana -3.5. Again, I wouldn't feel good about Giannis coming back. Dame, maybe. Although with that being an Achilles too, it's like, I almost don't want him to push it. But the Bucks are in trouble. No other way to say that. And again, it's a tough series to evaluate when you don't have one of the five best players in the world. And you know, you're going to play half the series without Damian Lillard. Let's get into Cleveland, Orlando. Cavs still -175 to win the series. This has been such a weird one to watch. Like the first two games, you're like, man, Orlando wasn't ready. They're just getting housed. Next two games, all of a sudden, Orlando looks like a team that could maybe challenge, I wouldn't say challenge Boston in round two, but at the very least, you know, make that somewhat interesting. I mean, this, as far as isolating the first two games and the next two games of a series, it's hard to think of a series that's had a starker contrast.
I agree. Game four was, it was Cleveland jumped out to, was it like a 10-point lead or something at the end of the first half? The second half for Orlando, I don't know what kind of halftime speech Jamal Mosley gave them coming out of the second half. They played with so much confidence. They were firing away from three. The energy was crazy. Franz Wagner specifically had the half of his life, was absolutely cooking everybody on Cleveland. And I just cannot believe that Cleveland, of these two teams, is now the team to have failed to score 100 points through four games in a crazy single game. I mean, to me, the roadmap for Orlando was we got to score 100 points. And they did. And they won both games. I don't know 100% what's happening with Cleveland. I think it's some of the same issues as last year. Not to get too hot takey with this, but
what?
Evan Mobley.
Who?
Look, I don't. This isn't the right phrasing. He's kind of holding the team back. Like this, he's not that good right now. He is not that good offensively. He just can't create offense for himself. Like there's not really, Mobley's not really scoring off of anything that's not an action for Evan Mobley. And even then it's kind of shaky. And so you have Donovan Mitchell just trying to play one-on-one. Garland's not having that. I mean, Garland's averaging 12 points a game right now. Garland and Mobley just need to be way better. It's bad.
Garland to me is the bigger issue right now, just because he has more experience. I'm not really shocked by what we've seen from Evan Mobley offensively. It's pretty shocking that Darius Garland's averaging 12 points a game on 42% shooting for the series. I think the other thing, and you know, we're clowning Orlando going into game three for just not being able to hit the broadside of a barn from three. The Cavs are 32 for 120 from beyond the arc in this series. That is horrible, right? I mean, even Donovan Mitchell's shooting 25% from three. I mean, Garland, that's kind of the one thing he's doing is hitting threes, but he hasn't taken that many. He's only taken 22 through four games. Like Caris LeVert has not given them anything. Max Strus and Georges Niang are 4 of 28 from beyond the arc. And, you know, I think it's easy to kind of place the blame at the foot of the role players, but I don't care who your opponent is. Like, it's really hard to win any NBA game, let alone a series, when guys like Strus and Niang, who are supposed to be your, you know, 40%+ marksman from three, it's like those are points that count, right? I think it's easier to blame Mobley. It's easier to blame Garland. Neither of those guys have been good. I'm not taking that away, but you need role players to hit threes, and there are very few teams that can survive that.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, that's what they got those guys for. And you know, this could just be a series where the home teams win their games. I really thought Cleveland was going to win the series, and I would have not been surprised if it was a sweep.
Me neither.
You and I did picks on another pod. I can't remember if I picked them to sweep or I picked them in five. Yeah. I may have picked them.
I think you took them in five and I took them to sweep because I was trying to really be assertive. That looked really dumb.
But look, I just have more faith in the Cavs. I think they have more talent, but yep. JB Bickerstaff is going to get fired they lose the series. And look, yeah, maybe I'm being a little too harsh on Evan Mobley, but there's just a lot. I don't know. I think they just they sort of just need that spot. They just need to be better. It's just I'm so confused on like what they're doing with Evan Mobley. It feels like a square peg in a round hole with Evan Mobley. He's so young compared to the rest of the team, and I think he's playing out of position. I just do not think he's a power forward. It's not a thing. Yeah. I don't know.
Mobley's an interesting case because he was so good early on that we just decided, all right, he's really good now. And once that happens, there's usually no going back. It takes something like this for there to be a revision on that. So I think if you're not like super dialed in on the Cavs night to night, you're just like, oh yeah, Evan Mobley, he's one of the best young players in the NBA. He's just going to keep getting better. He hasn't, man. He's plateaued. And I know there's been injuries and maybe that's part of it. You're asking him to play alongside, you know, a very clear true five in Jared Allen. You know, that's something they'll have to consider going forward. But part of the idea of why why Evan Mobley is one of the best young players in the NBA is that he was going to continue to expand his offensive game. And that just, it just hasn't happened. Right. I think he's, it kind of reminds me of like the way we used to talk about Bam. You know, it's like after the year Miami made the bubble finals against the Lakers, it was like, oh my God, this guy's going to keep getting better. And Bam has found ways, despite not improving his shooting range whatsoever. Like he's just not going to be a 3-point shooter. That was part of the deal 3-4 years ago, we thought, and it's just not. But he's found other ways to become super effective. And I'm not out on Mobley. I mean, he's still super young. He's been in kind of a weird situation. They hit the gas on the rebuild when they brought in Mitchell. I think if they do choose to do some sort of soft reset, I don't think it involves punting on Evan Mobley.
No.
But he's been disappointing. There's no question.
I wouldn't hate the soft reset. It's like, well, if Mitchell wants out, then we should probably just trade Jared Allen and really just reset this whole thing about Mobley and Garland. Garland's 24. Mobley's 22. It's like you're in a rebuild. Like you can pivot into that pretty quickly. But like I like your Bam comp, because what if Bam was playing power forward? I bet he'd look a lot like this. Where it's like, what? Like it's in like negative floor spacing. It's like occasionally he shoots a three because he feels like he has to. He's out on the perimeter. And it's like he can do that. He's mobile, but he really should be protecting the rim. And I don't think the pairing is doing anything good for the team. No. I don't think it's doing anything good for Evan Mobley. And that's sort of where my criticism of like Mobley stops, because at the end of the day, I do think he's playing out of position. And this is not an easy series for Garland, because he's got Jalen Suggs on him, and Garland's great, but he's also like, he's a small guard. He's like Dame size or Jalen Brunson size. And it's a really tough for those guys Brunson's having an out of body experience. Like what Brunson is doing is on such another level compared to what Darius Garland is doing in general, right, that it's hard to even compare the two.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, we can talk Knicks Sixers in a moment, but if you're going to be a guard of that size, the guys who have succeeded are either the ultra elite high volume 3-point shooters, or you have this super unique situation in Jalen Brunson, which almost has no comparison, right? I mean, it's like who plays like Jalen Brunson? I don't know. It's a guy who can get into the lane. I mean, he's such a unique body type. The finishing, the floaters, you know, when the 3-point shot's on, obviously that's part of his game, but I don't think you use that as the model, right? So Garland is another really interesting case. And I think he's had so many weird injuries over the last couple of years too, that it does feel like every time he gets going, there's some sort of roadblock. But we'll spend more time breaking down the Cavs offseason later on. We got to keep powering through these series. And I do want to talk best NBA teams of the last 20 years before we head out. Let's do a couple minutes on Sixers Knicks. That series, pick it up in earnest. I'll say this. Did not have a problem at all with Joel Embiid's comments on the crowd yesterday. For one, he was asked. He was provoked. It's not like he just grabbed the mic and was like, hey, I want to say all these bad things about Philly fans. He's like, look, we have great fans. But yes, it was disappointing. Like, he was straight up asked, was it disappointing for this to be a Knicks crowd in Philly? And it was, man. Like, it was confusing at times. Like, when you're watching this game, you know, if you had a second screen going or you're doing something on your phone, you're like, wait, oh yeah, this game's in Philly. Why is there such a loud pop every single time Jalen Brunson hits a shot? Sixers are in trouble here, no question about it. I was on the Knicks from the start. I believe you were on the Knicks in this series as well. Philly, you know, they've been close in most of these games. Like, this to be 3-1, it feels like it should be 3-1. I don't think that's a false result at all. But despite having a diminished version of Embiid, despite, you know, Tyrese Maxey playing through an illness for one game, despite Tobias Harris falling off a cliff, like, Philly's hung around in this series, honestly, a little bit more than I expected. And we could get on Embiid for his conditioning. We could get on him for always being hurt at the wrong time, but he's still carrying this team, man, night to night. He did not play well in game four, and they still, you know, almost snuck that one out in the fourth quarter. Like, if Embiid were to miss a game in this series, I don't think we realize how much this team would fall off a cliff.
In this year, I mean, the Knicks have only scored 4 more total points in this series than the 76ers, to your point about how close the series has been. I think it feels like New York should be up 3-1 because it seems like they're playing so much harder. It feels like they're playing harder than any team has ever played basketball before. Josh Hart's flying in for rebounds. Brunson is, I don't even know how, again, you sort of mentioned it earlier, but I don't even know how to describe what Brunson is doing. It's pivots. It's like so many of those big men like Dwight go to the like Hakeem Olajuwon school of like footwork. Oh, yeah. It feels like Jalen Brunson went there and actually learned something and applied it to basketball, unlike pretty much those other videos of like Dwight practicing all those moves. Embiid, like we can make a ton up, or we can talk a lot about how Embiid is not 100%, because he's not, but he's averaging 35 points a game and doing it pretty efficiently. And Maxey's giving them 29. And the third scorer on the team is Kelly Oubre with 12. Tobias Harris is scoring 9 points a game. They can't get anything out of anybody else. And it does. If you're a Philly fan, it has to kill you, because you're like, we've only lost by 4 points the whole series. That is really what we're down. 4 points.
Yeah. Yeah, the lack of a third option is frustrating. I think it's doubly frustrating because you're going up against a Knicks team that doesn't have Randall and that is also struggling to get contributions, right? It's not like, it's like Josh Hart has had an incredible series. What, by the way, one of the most unique players ever. Like, if you don't like Josh Hart, I don't know what to tell you. 17 rebounds yesterday, 5 assists, 3 blocks, 4 points, 0 of 7 shooting, 5 turnovers. Like, just a bizarre, weird game, and yet still had as big of an impact as anybody not named Jalen Brunson, who went for 47 and 10. I did think OG Anunoby had his best game of the series in game 4. Like, what he was doing on Embiid, specifically defensively, some of the hustle plays he had. He had a dunk late in this game where there was like 3 guys who I thought were going to block it, and he just powered right through it. Underrated how huge he is, by the way. I feel like I didn't notice that until he got to New York. Like, that dude is built like a linebacker.
Yeah, Anunoby is, he is huge. They list him at 6'7", 232, which is pretty big.
Yeah. Well, he's added, like, he's wearing like the Ben Wallace like bicep band too, which I think makes him look even bigger.
You, if you wear that bicep band, you gain 20 pounds of muscle, like just visually on the court. But yeah, you mentioned it's like, yes, the Knicks are sort of struggling to find like a second option, but they also have 5 players averaging at least 10 points a game.
Yes.
Aside from Brunson. So their contributions, they come at different points from different guys. Like, McBride will come in and just like jack 4 threes in 6 minutes. And you're like, this guy looks amazing, you know, and then Josh Hart will go over and it feels like he has like the second highest impact on the team. Right. Philly is not getting that. Like, they're just getting half the time when someone else scores, it feels like an accident. You know, Kyle Lowry looks like somebody jumping in front of cars to collect insurance money out there. And yet he has maybe been their third most impactful player.
Yeah.
And which is really frustrating, man. If I'm a 76ers fan, I'm a Bucks fan. I already feel frustrated, but if I'm a 76ers fan, man, it's tough. And I'm so happy for the Knicks. Like, I love seeing this because I love the crowd. You mentioned the crowd filling up in Philly. Both teams should actually wear white. I think that would make more sense when they're in Philly. It'd be like, yeah, both teams are they're both the home team, actually. Yeah.
Okay, a couple points on the Knicks that we could finally move on. You're totally right. That's a great point by you that they don't necessarily have a clear number 2 option, let alone a number 3 option. But they have time. The role players have timed their contributions perfectly.
Yes.
Right. I think that's like the best way to phrase it. It's like the day that Josh Hart goes 0-for-7, you get huge contributions from OG and Miles McBride. And like, Dante DiVincenzo has not been good overall in this series, but he hits the biggest shot of the series to essentially win you game 2. Hartenstein's kind of been very up and down. Mitchell Robinson, you know, didn't even play in the last game. He's been injured. You know, Precious Achiuwa, the little we've seen of him, he's not been great. But Bogdanovich is banged up now as well. That's kind of something to monitor for a team that's only played 9 guys this entire series. And, you know, 2 of those in Robinson and Achiuwa have been relatively limited minutes. So all of a sudden, like, if you take Robinson and Bogdanovich out of the mix, this becomes a little bit dicey for New York. But if there's any team that's fine playing with 6 or 7 guys, it would be them. It's what makes the Knicks the Knicks, right? Is that they don't have those other options, but these role players just step up in big moments. And it's been incredibly fun to watch. I think they have a pretty nice path to the East Finals. I don't think this team's beaten Boston, but the level of intensity that they're bringing defensively, the level of strategy and effort is going to be a shock to the Indiana Pacers, I think, compared to what they've seen for the Bucks.
I'm not going to make a prediction right now.
Whoa. What were you going to say?
They might sweep the Pacers. It's possible. I don't think the Pacers, after facing the Bucks, it's like, oh my God, we have to shoot contested shots. Right. You know, there was a clip. I should have sent it to you. It was late in the Bucks game, but the Bucks tried playing a zone or something.
Oh yeah.
Miles Turner gets the ball in the corner for a wide open 3. And there are 3 Bucks players guarding someone who does not have the ball.
Yep. I know exactly the player you're talking about.
It's going to be a shock to the Indiana Pacers, I think.
Yeah. Pacers, according to NBA.com stats, by the way, had 33 wide open 3s in game 3. That was a double overtime game. So they played more minutes, but 33, that's a lot. All right. Something that you and I were talking about over the weekend, it's a good way to wrap up the pod, and kind of cribbing this from Bill Simmons, who was talking the other day on his pod, was like, Denver's one of the 3 best teams, I think he said, of this century, the others being the 17 Warriors, of course, or kind of, it's more of like a period, like the Durant Warriors and then like the Shaq Kobe Lakers at the beginning of the decade. I think that's fair. I'm totally okay with Denver being in that conversation. I don't know if they're quite at the level of like the Durant Warriors to me are on a different level. That was, this team is 100% winning the title if they're healthy. I will not hear any other arguments. And you do forget how close like those Houston series were for a couple of years. You got to give credit to the Rockets. They actually gave them a pretty nice run. But Golden State, when healthy, was absolutely dominant. I think those Cavs teams in 16 and 17 were extremely good. Obviously, they won the title in 16. 17, they get there, just get housed by the Durant Warriors. And I think the 17 team might have been better than the 16. But the exercise that I want to do here is which other teams would be on the list? If we're going back to 2000, and given our ages, we're probably going to start this closer to the middle of that decade, because I was like 10 years old. I'm not going to give you like a take on why the 02 Sacramento Kings belong in that discussion, but what other teams are in that mix for you, or, you know, could make a top five list conceivably of the best teams of the last 25 years?
Well, I mean, I think you do have to mention, ironically, you mentioned Bill Simmons sort of like getting us on this idea, 07 Boston, like 07 to, I guess 08, when they basically put together their super team.
Yep.
That team was amazing. I was going through, I'm pulling it up right now. I lost some of the numbers, but you know, you can go on StatHead. And I was just looking up like teams that had the best records through like, 82 game season.
Sure.
Equivalent for like 3 years. And they were one of them. And look, I mean, they got it done. The question is, can you be one of the best teams of the past 20 years or whatever? You want to have the discussion and not have won the title? You have to have probably won the title to even be in the discussion, yes. Right?
The other way that I'm, for clarity purposes, I'm looking at this as like an era, and there's no defining parameters on this, but I guess you can nominate one specific team if you want. You know, if you want to say like the Kawhi Raptors or whatever, but to me, it's more like a 2 or 3 or in some cases longer year span, right? Like I would put the 11 through 13 Miami Heat on that list, for example. And if you want to just say the 11-12 team, or I think it was the 12-13 team that went on the 27 game win streak, you could do that. But I think in my opinion, to be in that inner circle, you got to win a title during that run. There are some teams that got close, maybe made a finals, and we could discuss those. But yeah, I think you have to win one during that run to be in this mix. You brought up a good point that I want to let you state, because I don't want to steal the thunder from you, but we were talking about this off air over the weekend, and something that you said as a mark in favor of Denver is that they deserve credit for how good they've been relative to their conference, which I think is very true, and relative to the strength of the league overall now versus perhaps 10 or 15 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, Denver, they're going through this Western Conference right now, which, and this is just this year, but we have an OKC team that finishes above them in the standing. So there is a team regular season better than them. But Minnesota has, Anthony Edwards rising up. You have the Clippers with Kawhi, Paul George, and James Harden all on the same team. You have the Luka, who is in the conversation, who's a top five in the conversation. The whole Phoenix super team, regardless of what you think about them, at least Kevin Durant and Devin Booker are in the same conference. The Lakers are still hanging around. Like, the conference is so good. LeBron, was cruising through the East when the East was pretty bad some of those years.
Yes.
And I think that should be at least a talking point in the discussion of like, is this team one of the best ever?
I think it could go both ways, because so the LeBron teams you're talking about, I would say are probably the middle to end of that Heat era, and then certainly the Cavs era, the second Cavs era, when the Atlanta Hawks are standing in the Eastern Conference Finals in your way. Even those Pacers teams that gave the Heat some run. Good teams. I don't think anybody's talking about them as like an all-time great team, but the Cavs were also that much better than the rest of the conference. So it's like, I want to give them that credit, but at the same time say that, yes, the path is certainly easier to get to the finals for that LeBron Cavs team in 2015, 16, 17 than it is in the East right now, or certainly in the West right now, or in the West at the time. The other teams that came to mind for me immediately were, like I said, the 11 through 13 Heat. They won back-to-back titles. They beat, in my opinion, two really good teams in those finals. The Durant, Westbrook, Harden, Thunder, and then a really, really good Spurs team that, of course, beat them in the finals the next year. So I don't think there's much to take away from that 27-game win streak, all-time historic run. The 16-17 Cavs, who got one title and then got blown out in 2017. And then one that I think goes a little bit undercovered, the 13 through 15 San Antonio Spurs. who lost that finals, you know, on the Ray Allen shot in 13, came back with an all-time dominant finals in 2014, just steamrolling that Heat team, and then had a pretty nice run. If you want to extend this all the way to like 2016-17, like we're talking like the tail end of the Duncan run, they were still, they put up 67 and 61 wins in 2015-16 and 16-17. And, you know, 1 year lost in the second round, and then the next year lost in the conference finals. But again, you're going up against the Warriors in both of those years.
That's the team I was going to next, was this Spurs team, which, you know, the Spurs have been so bad now for half a decade, like bad, that it, obviously you don't forget who they used to be, but it just feels like it was a different era. It really was. Because if you know, Steph kind of changed basketball in like 2015.
Yeah.
And that's like right at the end of the Spurs run. So those two things sort of sit on an axis. But yeah, man, I mean, that was the epitome of like team basketball, to some extent, like what the Knicks feel like they're trying to put together. You know, it's like, can we be sort of this version of this, like with our guys? I know this is hyperbole in terms of like, I'm just gassing up the Knicks, but it's sort of like, yes, we have, you know, the one generational star in Tim Duncan. And then can we, through coaching and just guys accepting their role, can we sort of be the perfect team? I'm going to throw out two other quick contenders. The early 2000s Dallas Mavericks, who did not win a title, but there was a stretch from 02 to 07, however you want to classify it, a 5-year stretch. You could probably go farther back. So 2001, they win 57, then 60, then 52, 58, 60, 67, which is through 06, 07. They went to the finals once and they lost. That is a pretty ridiculous run of wins. And then basically right after that, like they sort of handed the baton to the late 2000s Lakers, the Pau Gasol, Kobe Bryant Lakers, who were, it was pretty quick, but they went to the finals 3 years in a row. They won back to back and went to the finals 3 years in a row. That was an awesome team. Pau was incredible.
Got a little bit of like 1.5 elite years from Andrew Bynum, who was actually like extremely good for a short period of time. No, you're right. That Dallas team kind of choking away that finals against the Heat, I feel like almost eliminates them. But if you're talking regular season dominance, no question. I was just pulling up a similar stretch to talk about the 02 through 07 San Antonio Spurs. And I'm looking at, you know, how many total wins they had in that span. And I expected them to be head and shoulders above the rest of the league. They're tied with the Mavs for most regular season wins over that 5-year span. The difference, of course, is the Spurs won 3 titles in those 5 years. So I think they absolutely have to be mentioned. I think you look back like that like 03 to 07 era to me was like the depths of NBA talent. And we talked about this, you know, fairly frequently, probably more than any other pod, as far as like, go look at the 99, 2000, 2001, 2002 drafts before the LeBron, Melo, Bosh, Wade class. Like it was bad. It was like back to back to back, like really bad drafts where you're getting maybe like one or two guys who made like a couple all-star games. So the league hit kind of like rock bottom. And I don't think, like, if you pull up that Spurs roster, you're like, oh yeah, you know, they're a pretty good team. Obviously, I think we forget how great Tim Duncan was at his peak. You forget how great Ginobili and Parker and, you know, some of the intangibles that came with those Spurs teams were. So I think they're a tough one to try to like put in a time machine and be like, how successful would they be now versus, you know, the 2024 Denver Nuggets. But obviously we have to mention the Spurs team that, you know, completely dominated half the decade.
Yeah. And this team isn't really in contention. To me, this is like really where it falls off. But the Oklahoma
Don't
City
mention
Thunder,
that 62 win Hawks team. Don't you dare.
No. The early 2010s OKC Thunder with the original OKC team, where they start in 2009 with 50 wins, then go 55, 47, 60, 59. They go to Western Conference Finals in 11, then they lose the finals in 12, then Western Conference Semis, then Western Conference Finals to round it out in 14 before not making the playoffs the next year. But that team, you know, that's one of the best what if teams ever.
Yeah.
Right. But because we talk about it like a big what if, it's easy to forget that like it actually happened for 5 years. Like it was an amazing team for half a decade.
Yeah, I think they're in the same category to me, and maybe a slight step up as those Rockets teams that just kept running into the Warriors. Like in a normal NBA decade, the Rockets probably break through at least once and make a finals. You know, do they win it with James Harden and Chris Paul, or you know, whatever variation of that team you want to throw out there? Maybe, maybe not. I don't know. But I don't want to penalize that team for running into basically an unbeatable Warriors team for a couple of years. I think there's maybe a slight argument for the Bucks team that won in 21, but even as a Bucks fan, I'm not going to sit here and say that that was like an all-time team that would that could challenge any from the last 25 years. Very, very good team that played very well together. Guys knew their role. Upgrading from Bledsoe to Holiday, feels like is what really swung that. I think they're kind of on the doorstep for me. They're not quite in that conversation.
No. And obviously this is, we are getting farther down the conversation, because I do think those top three teams that we mentioned at the very top, I think those are the teams.
Those being the Lakers, the Nuggets, and the Warriors?
The big three, Heat.
Okay, so Heat are in that conversation for me. And we need to consider the original source, I think, when we're talking about which teams get nominated. The Heat are in there, man. They won 27 games in a row. They won back-to-back titles.
Yeah.
They have to be.
I don't know if I'm ready to say Denver is the best team of the past 20, basically since the turn of the century.
They're not.
Do they have the potential to get there? I think they would arguably maybe have. I don't want to say they would have the least talent of any team, but that just, I mean, Jokic individually is just he's amazing, man. But we still need to see more. I think.
Well, so that is the best mark in their favor, I think, is that I don't think if you told somebody just go look at the basketball reference page for all these teams that we're talking about and, count up the all NBAs or the guys who are future Hall of Famers. Denver loses that debate every time, right? Like you're comparing them to a Warriors team that has four future Hall of Famers, to a Lakers team that had the two best players in the league for a three-year stretch on the same team. Like that's the fact that Denver's in this conversation with this roster, I think, is what makes it so impressive, right? It's like, I do think Jamal Murray is very underrated. Like I don't think we talk about him in as high of an esteem as we should. Like him being as good as he's been in huge moments as a number two option is a little bit underrated, but like nobody's caping for Eric Gordon to make the Hall of Fame. Like Andre Iguodala might make the Hall of Fame. He's a finals MVP. Aaron Gordon's not significant finals MVP. Like there are a lot of questions about Michael Porter Jr. as a two-way player. This team doesn't really have a great bench whatsoever. It's like that. I think that's where I would say like the Warriors, the 17 Warriors to me would, I think, annihilate this Denver team because they were just that good. Nothing against Denver. I just think that Warriors team was on a completely different level. You had absolute peak Curry, peak Thompson, peak Durant, peak Draymond. You're still getting the tail end of Iguodala, who's 2 years removed from winning the finals MVP. Like that team is the one that you look at and you're like, this has to be the greatest team. Look at the assemblage of talent. I don't think you say that about Denver. They're just like a normal team that got extremely good.
Yeah, I think I'm trying to find it. There was 1 year on Basketball Reference, they actually have the preseason odds to win the title. And the Warriors 1 year they were favored to win the title most of those years. Yeah, 1 year. So I think in 17-18, they were -187 to win the title.
That's insane.
Yeah.
The Nuggets this year, for context, were +450, which is still really low.
Still really low.
You don't see minus money.
No. And the next best team that year was Cleveland at +515 and then Boston at +1200.
Right.
But that's that. It doesn't always have to come back to the gambling market, but that tells you like you had to give up money. You had to lay money to just assume the Warriors were going to win the title.
Yeah. No, I think that's a great note to close on. Fun discussion. Wish we had more time to dive in on this, but I think we hit all the contenders. I don't know if we need to give shine to like the 09 Magic. I don't know if we're going to get
you don't want to talk about like
LeBron did to that team before Kawhi showed up in every single playoffs has disqualified them. They do not get a seat at this table. Good stuff as always, man. If you want to hear more from us, you can catch us on NBA Radio. We'll be on tonight. We'll be on Wednesday for sure. The schedule will dictate how many shows we have the rest of the week, but SiriusXM NBA Radio, 7 p.m. Eastern. We'll have James Posey on tonight helping us talk Boston, Miami, OKC, New Orleans, Lakers, Nuggets. I think he's played for three of those teams, so we should be able to go deep with James. Really looking forward to that. Alex, talk to you later, man, and see you on this podcast next Monday.
Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring podcasts on the Blue Wire Network. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System yet, then you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. Wherever you are across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's Unified, UNIFYD, healing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE system.